A farmer can make solid plans and put in hours of hard work, but if Mother Nature is cruel, it can all come to nothing. That's one of the reasons we have a farm bill. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is a special joint broadcast with KCUR in Kansas City in conjunction with Harvest Public Media. As the Farm Bill is debated in the U.S. House, this hour we're going to talk about the politics of farm policy, including crop insurance and the Conservation Reserve Program. We'll find out who wants what's at stake for farmers large and small, and how these programs affect the rest of us. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is a special broadcast in conjunction with Harvest Public Media. And this morning, we're also welcoming the listeners of Central Standard on KCUR in Kansas City. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, in the Farm Bill has been getting a lot of attention lately, but there is a great deal more at play in this year's Farm Bill. This hour, we're going to talk about crop insurance and the Conservation Reserve Program. We'll find out what's at stake and why, even if you're not a farmer, you should care. Later in the hour, I'll talk with experts who have very different opinions about crop insurance, and we'll find out how enrollment in the Conservation Reserve Program has been changing in the Midwest, how things could change with the new Farm Bill, and what the issues are for farmers, the environment, and for wildlife. My first guest today is Frank Morris. He is founder and executive supervisor for Harvest Public Media and news director for KCUR in Kansas City. Hello, Frank.
Morning.
And we're going to start by focusing on the crop insurance program. What changes are being proposed in the Farm Bill?
Well, the Senate passed a relatively minor changes that would limit the amount of subsidies or cut the amount of subsidies that farmers who make over $750,000 a year would be able to get on their premiums for crop insurance, and require that farmers who use federally subsidized crop insurance adhere to environmental regulations that have already been in place for years for every other farm, for the farm title programs. So relatively minor adjustments. The House, of course, you know, we've got all these more than 100 amendments, and a lot of them have to do with crop insurance. You know, so some of them would you know, cut much deeper capping subsidies, premium subsidies at $50,000, or, you know, and doing other sorts of means testing for premium subsidies. Premium subsidies are where most of the money is. That's where most of the action is in the House as well. But there's also some talk of cutting the amount of money or the margins that the companies, crop insurance companies, make on selling crop insurance.
And who are the interested parties? Who's in there lobbying hard right now?
Well, I think, you know, just in broad strokes, you've got some Democrats who would like to reverse these proposed cuts to the you know, nutrition programs. They're the ones who are looking, I think, most aggressively at cutting crop insurance to free up some money to pay for the nutrition programs.
And with the climate in the House right now, what are the possibilities? How do you think this could turn out?
Well, I'm really not in a good position to make a prediction about that. I mean, you know, obviously, Democrats are in the minority, and they, you know, are going to be, I think it is predominantly Democratic. Of course, a lot of Republicans don't like some of the, you know, the government intervention in various parts of the farm safety net. And, you know, so there are some interesting coalitions with environmentalists and some conservatives, you know, going after certain parts of the program. But I'm really not in a good position to make a prediction.
Okay, well, we will have to wait and see. But in the next the next few minutes, we're going to find out how crop insurance is working and what really is at stake. Are there any amendments in particular, Frank, that you will be watching as it's debated in the House?
Well, I mean, just, you know, and just to boil it down to crop insurance, you know, I don't think that – I think this, it's basically going to be nipping and tucking. Obviously, there are some people who would like to make deep cuts into crop insurance. It doesn't seem like that's probably going to happen. If something does, you know, break out and there's some compromise that really cuts into premium subsidies for crop insurance, then that's going to be interesting. But again, there's nothing, you know, we'll just see. I mean, the Senate entertained a lot of provisions that would have cut crop insurance subsidies pretty significantly, and they were generally steamrolled. They didn't fare well in the Senate. I don't know if the House is more likely to go for something like that, but my assumption is that the House may be less likely to go for those kind of cuts. So there's nothing in particular that, you know, jumps out. It's the same sort of debate as we saw in the Senate over, again, sort of cutting around the edges, more or less, with some outliers, but more or less, I mean, we're looking at modifying crop insurance, not doing away with the subsidy, for instance, or really making big, big changes.
Okay. Frank, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Sure.
Frank Morris is founder and executive supervisor for Harvest Public Media and news director for KCUR in Kansas City. And now we're going to get a firsthand look at how crop insurance can work. Wayne Johnson is a farmer from Winnebago County in Iowa. He farms about 4,000 acres near Forest City, so he is one of those larger operations that we were talking about just a moment ago, and we've caught up with him in the field today. Hello, Wayne.
Hi.
And you're actually in the field planting today?
That's right. It's our fifth day in the field this season.
And this is an awfully awfully late planting day. Have you ever planted this late before?
In 93, we had a similar situation where we planted soybeans this late, but I've had to abandon probably half of my corn acres, and it's not very pretty out here today. I see one of my tractors is stuck about a half a mile south of me, and we're growing around wet spots, and we're having a hard time out here.
All right, and for people who aren't familiar with what's been going on in Iowa specifically, we've had a lot of rain and a lot of flooding in the state this year. Wayne, you are in a situation this year where you have to make a claim for crop insurance?
Yeah, that'd be correct.
Yeah. All right. Well, walk me through the process. What is your claim?
Could you say that again? I didn't quite hear that.
Tell me about the claim that you're making this year. How much land were you unable to plant? What are you asking for?
Sure. Well, so far, we've not been able to plant about 2,700 acres of corn, so there's just not been a window to get in it and do it. And I don't know, most of us as farmers are around-the-clock kind of workers. You know, I think that's true of most American people. You know, we're eager to get our projects done, if they're in the backyard or if they're our business or for me on my farm. We aren't afraid to get out there and get after it, but if the weather doesn't allow it, we can't. So
right.
That's kind of what's happened this year.
Right. So how much do you think you'll get as a payout on your crop insurance claim for this year?
Well, I'm not done planting, so I have quite a so this is only the second day of soybeans. And yesterday, where I would normally get maybe 400 acres, 500 acres of soybeans a day, yesterday I was able to get in 131 acres. That's how much slower it goes when you have mud and you're stuck. And,
wow.
And it's just like driving 100 miles. But if it's ice and snow and you can only go 5 miles an hour, you don't get there in 2 hours. You know, it can take you 10 hours, you know, going 100 miles. And that's kind of what's happening. And so the claim will be whatever adjusters come out and look at it. I'm insured at about $960 an acre. And if it's a failed planting, you take that times 60%, And so that's around $550 an acre. And so you take that times 2,700 or 2,700 acres, and that's what the claim will be. I don't actually know what that number is, but it'll be over $1 million.
Right. And you are a large operation. You also have 16 employees, right? So, I mean, this is a business, but a larger business than many farms in Iowa. How much do you pay every year in premiums for crop insurance?
Well, it's around $30 an acre. And so, if I had 4,000 acres of row crop, that'd be $120,000 that I would pay out. The thing to keep in mind is that everybody wants pie. You know, people that own the land want more rent. John Deere wants more for their tractors. Employees want benefits and higher wages each year. And for us as an operation on soybeans, I would make around $50 an acre. And so that's not a very big margin for $500 to $600 an acre in expenses. It'll be about $550 an acre in expenses on soybeans. We notoriously work on less than a 10% margin as farmers. And so that it's just a very low margin, high capital intensive, lots of hard, it's still hard, dirty work.
Right.
That's just what it is.
How many times in your career have you had to make a crop insurance claim?
We had a crop insurance. So in 93, I had a claim. And then last year, we had a major drought. And it looks like I will this year. So this would be the third year in, say, 32 years of farming.
Wow. So with as much as you've been paying for crop insurance, you have paid for what you'll get out of the system, it sounds like.
Basically, it's just like buying insurance on a car. You would just as soon never use it.
Right.
You don't like paying the premium. If the premium is always too high. And for homeowners, it doesn't make any difference what insurance premium you're paying. It's too much, or you feel like it's too much. Go ahead.
Right. We're almost out of time. When you're watching these debates about the farm bill, what would happen to you if the amount that the government was willing to put into your crop insurance premiums was lowered?
Well, let's just say they're putting $20 an acre into it. It would cut about 50% of my profits in soybeans. So food is an important thing to every one of us, and we talk about food nutrition programs, but if we don't have food to begin with, frankly, if the crop insurance program went away, I would not farm. I would just quit.
Wayne, thank you so much for talking with me today, and I hope your planting goes better today. Wayne Johnson is a farmer from Winnebago County in Iowa. We'll continue our conversation about the crop insurance program in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're also being heard on KCUR in Kansas City in a special joint broadcast made possible by Harvest Public Media. And this hour we're focusing on a couple of major issues that are being decided in this year's Farm Bill. Later in the hour we'll talk about the Conservation Reserve Program, but right now we're talking about crop insurance. And we just heard from a farmer who farms 4,000 acres in northern Iowa about how crop insurance is working for him right now. And joining me now is Bruce Babcock. He is the Cargill Endowed Chair of Energy Economics, the director of the Bio-Based Industry Center, and a professor of economics at Iowa State University. Hello, Bruce. Hello, Bruce. Can you hear me? All right. I'll also introduce Eric Sorensen, who is vice president of crop insurance services for Agribusiness Insurance Services. Hello, Eric.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you very much for being here today. And is Bruce available now? Bruce, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, good. That's so good to hear. All right. Bruce, we're going to start with you. We were just listening to a farmer talk about how much he pays in insurance premiums and the kind of payout he'll probably get this year because of all the flooding in Iowa. This is an issue you've been doing a lot of research about. You've become something of a lightning rod on the issue as well. But in your opinion, tell us what is wrong with crop insurance as it's been working over the last few years.
Well, crop insurance is a very good risk management tool for farmers to use. My only criticism of the program is how much it's costing taxpayers to deliver that program. I mean, the example we just heard, we have a 4,000-acre farmer. He gets about – he pays $30 in premium, but the taxpayer pays another $20, and another $10 per acre is paid to the insurance industry to deliver that crop insurance. So if you add that up for that one farmer, 4,000 acres at $30 subsidy, by my calculation, that's about $120,000 going to that one farmer in terms of premium. It's just that the explosion in cost of the crop insurance program since 2005 has just made it a what I've written anyway is a bloated government program. And so I think crop insurance is a great risk management tool that farmers can use, but we don't need to subsidize it as much.
Okay. And of course, that's not what we were hearing from Wayne, who we were just talking to a few minutes ago. He's running on a very small margin and doesn't think he can afford to pay any more for crop insurance. So what would you say to his statement?
Well, there's lots of production costs out there. There's seed, there's fertilizer, there's diesel fuel, there's labor costs. And the cost of risk is just another production cost. So if we were, our farmers were used to a 50% subsidy for their fertilizer, and then suddenly some academic from Iowa State said, well, we need to reduce that subsidy, you know what the reaction would be. How can I afford my fertilizer? And it's exactly the same with crop insurance. They've gotten used to having that premium subsidized. The industry has gotten used to having all of their costs associated with delivering the program subsidized by the taxpayer. And once you get those subsidies in place, it's nearly impossible to get rid of them because you get used to them. You can't imagine a existing without them. So I think that, like with fertilizer costs, just like with crop insurance costs, I think that farmer and that land would be the farmer would continue to farm that land. Prices would adjust. And what we would see is that land stay in production. No one's going to go hungry if you get rid of that $30 an acre in premium subsidy.
Okay. And Eric, I'm sure you are very eager to respond. But Bruce, I want one follow-up here. Are you saying that the insurance industry is charging too much for premiums because they are depending on these federal subsidies as well? Is there a pricing problem?
No, they have no control over price. The USDA sets the premiums. What the industry gets is subsidies from the government to deliver the program. And it's those subsidies that have, for example, agent commissions, they're paid for by taxpayers, and they've tripled since 2005. And it just that program has just escalated in cost dramatically.
All right. And we are eager to hear from you as well. If you have opinions about this, concerns about the crop insurance program, concerns about the so call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. That number again is 866-780-9100. And again, Eric Sorensen is with us, Vice President of Crop Insurance Services for Agribusiness Insurance Services. Eric, can you respond to what you heard Bruce saying for us?
Well, I'll give it my best shot. I guess without getting too deep into the weeds, I just want to start with what's hard for a lot of us in the crop insurance industry who work hard every day to kind of provide a backbone, a financial backbone for farmers to be able to take the risks that they take every year willingly, knowing that they could lose big money. It's hard to understand why we're fighting this fight so hard every year. I guess I would start out with the fact that not a fact, but a statement was made that crop insurance commissions for agents have tripled since 05. That's just simply not true. I don't know if there's some corner of the country where agents are making triple what they did in 2005. It sure isn't around here.
Okay, well, let's I can't settle that one, so we'll have to choose who to believe there. But let's talk about subsidies and, you know, the idea that larger operations should have the amount of subsidy that they're receiving for their crop insurance premiums lowered. How do you see that affecting farmers?
Well, you know, first off, I guess I don't know exactly how many farmers would be affected by the different amendments out there for cutting premium subsidy, but I'm aware of one $750,000 adjusted gross income limit for premium subsidy. I'm aware of another amendment proposing a $250,000 limit. I think what these folks fail to understand is how much money is involved in running a successful crop farming operation. I mean, when you talk about the equipment costs alone just being astronomical, you know, a new combine today is typically $400,000. New tractor might be anywhere from $200,000 to $300,000. You know, the grain carts, storage facilities, labor, fuel, all these costs have gone up astronomically. The other thing I'd say is certainly this country has a stake, whether you're directly involved in agriculture or not, in affordable food. And a lot of the innovations that have come about with GPS technology, better farming practices to maximize yield while conserving the land, have come about simply because there's enough profit to put into research and development to allow those things to occur. Versus like a country, let's say China, and I don't want to pick on China per se, but they just come to mind as being a country that operates maybe decades ago in lack of technology use.
You talk about how all of these other costs have gone up astronomically. Of course, commodity prices have also gone up astronomically. So when the farmer sells the corn and the soybeans at the end of the season, they're getting a significantly higher return on the investments that they've put in through the year. So how does that equation balance out?
That's a great question. I would agree, and most farmers would agree, again, depending on your experience recently, we've had some large losses due to weather-related disasters. A lot of money can be made in farming if things go right, but also I'd say to that, more money can be lost these days than years past in farming if things don't go right. If you're not properly covered, or if we didn't have proper crop insurance, or some have proposed taking away the harvest price option last year, that would have been absolutely devastating with the 2012 drought if we didn't have the harvest price option.
Bruce, when you look at the system, do you think that smaller farmers have the same advantages as the larger operations when it comes to crop insurance?
Well, crop insurance is neutral with regards to farm size. So when you're small, you get an aggregate small amount of subsidy. When you're big, you get a big amount of subsidy, and the same with indemnity. So it's really on a per-acre basis, and so it's neutral with regards to size.
Okay. I've talked with people who are doing alternative agriculture in the past, you know, running CSAs, fruit and vegetable growers who have a diverse amount of crops growing on their land. And I've talked with farmers who have said, well, crop insurance doesn't work for us in that way. Do you think that there's a problem with how crop insurance insures what we're growing on the land if it doesn't take into account some of the diversity that you can have in your crops?
Well, crop insurance is really meant for commercial agriculture where data exists so that premiums can be set because farmers are being asked to pay a portion of the premium, and so the federal government wants to try to ensure that that the premium that they're asked to pay is lines up with what they're supposed to pay. With the great diversity of possible crops out there, there simply isn't the data that exists in order to do that. But crop insurance is becoming increasingly a social program. And that's why you see the requirements for conservation compliance and for adjusted gross income limits being placed on the program, because it's becoming just another kind of farm commodity income support program. So if that continues, I think you will see more and more effort being devoted, making it less of an insurance program where the actuarials are really needed and more of a social program where maybe some small, more diverse types of crops can be covered.
Eric, if a farmer does not have crop insurance and they have a complete failure of crop, if there's a terrible flood or a terrible drought or something like that, is there any assistance available for them?
You know, today there really isn't. If there is any, I guess I'm not aware of it, or it'd be very limited in scope. Again, not understanding all the rules and regulations of the non-crop insurance safety net, I would just say that I've heard comments time and time again from my own customers to say, you know, I wish they'd just let me have crop insurance, forget these other programs that seem to be complicated and unfair and late in coming. But to answer your question more directly, I would say it would be absolutely devastating. Some of the yields that came out of especially Illinois and Indiana with last year's drought, where there were some complete crop failures, or in some cases maybe half of a crop or less, that could spell bankruptcy just in 1 year.
When there's a federal disaster declaration, do farmers get included in that?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm wondering is if a county is declared a disaster area by the federal government, would there be some sort of assistance to a farmer who didn't have crop insurance in that case?
Yes and no. It's not sufficient, I would say that. It is not even close to being sufficient. The other problem with it is because a lot of the past, you know, we're working through the new Farm Bill language right now, but the past Farm Bill basically stated that for one of the key components of the safety net outside of the federal crop insurance program, it was called the SURE program, required that you buy crop insurance. And your SURE guarantee was based on how much crop insurance you purchased. Of course, there were some limitations to that as well. But the main problem that I heard from producers with the SURE program was it was too little too late. And it was something that you couldn't necessarily count on because you had the risk of, well, what if I had a problem in the county, but other parts of the county were good enough to where it wasn't declared a disaster agency and wouldn't set into motion the SURE payment. The other problem is SURE is so limited in scope that no ag lender would reasonably consider that as a risk management program or a hedge against their loan. The other problem I heard, simply put, from one of my producers was, Eric, if I'd have needed the SURE payment, it would have come about a year after the bankruptcy sale.
Bruce, when the rules for the crop insurance program as it is working now were written, there was a goal of getting more farmers to get crop insurance, right?
Yes, indeed. And when those rules were working, it actually, when those rules were passed in 2000, farmers were participating in crop insurance to a very large extent. And I agree with Mr. Sorensen. I think we ought to just jettison all the other disaster programs and rely on crop insurance. My problem is that that the cost of that program is so high. Just to give you an example how big these costs are, Congressman Duncan and Senator Flake introduced an amendment that would have just returned the premium subsidy formulas to what existed before those rules were changed in 2000. That amendment would have saved $40 billion over 10 years. Now, that's a lot of money. There's a great amount of debate going on in the House right now over $20 billion worth of savings from the SNAP program. Just the Flake-Duncan amendment would have saved $40 billion, so you could have saved $20 billion, given it to a deficit reduction, and then offset all of the reductions in SNAP and still had a tremendously strong safety net for farmers. It just shows you how escalated the cost of this program have become.
Eric, how do you respond to that?
You know, when I first started in crop insurance, it was February of 1998. And about 99, there were, I believe, 13 counties in eastern Iowa that were piloted and in increasing the subsidy percentage and allowing 80 and 85% levels of coverage for the first time, just to see how that would go. And basically, the reason for the pilot was to try to see, can we get farmers to buy enough crop insurance and spend more of their own money in addition to, you know, more subsidy, obviously, to get us to a situation where we don't have to keep coming up with ad hoc disaster assistance. In other words, can we just get it to where farmers could rely on crop insurance alone? Because the main structure and backbone of it just makes financial sense, and the delivery mechanisms are already in place to make that happen. And the other thing that they did was increasing the subsidy percentage so that not just farmers are having options like 80, 85%, but they're actually realistically affordable for the first time. And it was a resounding success. They actually had more producers buying higher levels of coverage and had more producers buying coverage for the first time. So I guess I would take a little bit of issue to, do we want to go back to the 2000 and before? I think we know what results that would get. It would result in less participation of farmers buying crop insurance at all, and farmers buying enough crop insurance to not need ad hoc disaster assistance. So I don't think those spreadsheet numbers can really be looked at in a vacuum. There are consequences when you drop the subsidy levels back to pre-2000 levels.
And we have about 20 seconds left. Bruce, if you want to respond to that.
Well, of course, if you subsidize, lower the price of a product through a taxpayer subsidy, you're going to get more purchases of that product. I mean, that's no surprise. The question is, would an adequate safety net be available to farmers and so that they could buy as much insurance as they want using their own dollars? And the answer is yes. And it saves taxpayers $40 billion over 10 years.
Bruce Babcock, thank you very much for being here today.
It's been a pleasure.
Bruce Babcock is Cargill Endowed Chair for Energy Economics. He's also an economics professor at Iowa State University. Eric Sorensen, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Charity.
Eric Sorensen is Vice President of Crop Insurance Services for Agribusiness Insurance Services. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're also being heard on KCUR in Kansas City, a special joint broadcast with Harvest Public Media. And we're going to turn now to another important issue in the Farm Bill, the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP. For people who don't know, it's a land conservation program. It's administered by the Farm Service Agency. And the way it works is that a farmer enrolls land in the CRP program for a contracted length of time. They remove that land from agricultural production in exchange for a yearly rental payment. And some of the goals of the program are to take environmentally sensitive land out of production, to reduce pollution, and increase wildlife habitat. We've been hearing a lot lately about farmers taking their land out of CRP to take advantage of high commodity prices. But whatever the reason for taking land out of CRP, it's not a simple process. Ethan Book and his wife farm at Crooked Gap Farm, which is near Knoxville. And he took some of the land out of CRP. Hello, Ethan.
Yes.
You purchased a 40-acre farm, and when you purchased the farm, a lot of the land was in CRP, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I think it was around like 31 or 32 acres were in the Conservation Reserve program in a couple different plots.
Okay, so were you purchasing part of what had been a larger farm operation in the past?
It had changed hands fairly recently before we purchased it. We purchased it in 2008, I believe, and it had changed hands not long before that, but the previous owner, so two owners before us, had owned it as part of his farming operation for at least 20 years, I think.
And do you know why the land, this acreage, was put in the CRP program to begin with?
It was put in the program. Actually, we were kind of lucky. The farmer that owned the land that put it in the program stopped by our house just to check on some of the CRP ground that he had put in, actually, a week or two ago. And he had put it in. He lived and farmed quite a ways away and had put it in the program in the mid-90s, 93, 94, somewhere around there, just because the yields that he could get off it compared to the Conservation Reserve contracts that he could get, it was a better deal. It's a really hilly, sloping field, and so runoff and erosion were a problem on it.
Now, if you're buying a 40-acre farm and 31 or 32 acres of it is in CRP, I can imagine that you needed to get some of that land out of CRP. How did you make that decision?
Sure. Well, when we purchased the ground, it was 40 bare acres. There was no fence, there was no house, there was no buildings, and we were purchasing it to live on and start a farm. And so, we looked at a couple different things, which were to buy out just a portion of it so that we could build our house and get started on the place. But then, you know, we just decided that it really wouldn't help us get the farm going because we wanted to graze animals and things like that. And we were going to need more land than just, you know, a few acres to build a house. So in the end, we just decided buying it all out was probably the best option for us.
And what kind of process do you have to go to take land out of CRP?
Yeah, you know, in the you're basically breaking a contract, I guess is, you know, probably the legal way to say it. And so what we had to do was we had to pay back all the money that had been paid out in that contract to up to that point, which I believe at our case was about 4 years' worth of payments. And I don't even really remember how much it was at this time. And then we had to pay interest, which varied from year to year on the whatever the interest rate was for that year. So, like, we paid back 2007, and it might have been 4%. We paid back 2006. It might have been 2%. So we had to pay those fees or interest on top. And then also there was a 25% liquidated damages payment, which was 25% of 1 year's payment.
That sounds expensive.
Yeah, it was. It was. And, you know, it was just one of the parts of the purchase price that we just had to look at it and say, you know, this is going to be just part of our purchase price. And so when we look at how much we're paying per acre, we just need to up it by whatever it's going to cost to take this ground out of the CRP program. And in our area, there wasn't a lot of 40-acre plots available, which was the most that we could afford. And so we liked the location. And so it just kind of, it was just one of those necessary evils, if you want to call it that.
What kind of insight do you feel you've gained into the CRP program from this process?
Yeah, you know, it's a program that has lots of ups and downs. And, you know, I feel like conservation reserve is a big part of the way we farm. And so, you know, I feel like we're reserving, you know, we're doing some great things for conservation on our farm. And I feel personally, and, you know, I'm somebody could disagree with me, but personally, I feel like we've improved the ground since 2008, since we've actually started using land in farm production. We've actually improved the ground compared to having it somewhat fallow for 14 years previously.
All right. Well, Ethan, thank you so much for talking with me today.
No problem. Thank you.
Ethan Book and his wife farm Crooked Gap Farm near Knoxville. And John Whitaker is with me now. He is state executive director of the Farm Service Agency in Iowa, administrators of CRP. Hello, John.
How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
You bet.
And I described the CRP program a little bit earlier, that there's a contract that's drawn up to take this land out of production for a length of time. How long are these contracts usually for?
Well, contracts are 10 or 15 years, depending on the particular program that a producer enters. When the program first started, they were only 10-year contracts, but then they started to look at things such as tree planting that needed to be a longer term. And since then, they have added that 15-year term to other things other than tree planting.
All right. And what are the goals of the program?
Well, the goals have changed since its first inception. It was first brought about to be protect soil, to improve water quality, and it had a purpose also of lowering the surpluses that we had in crop production at that time. We were in the 80s producing more than we were able to use. We had buyout programs and things like that. Since then, those objectives have narrowed down to protecting soil and water and wildlife resources, preserving water quality and habitat, and to look also at state and regional conservation goals.
And in the Farm Bill, this is, of course, this conversation is all about money as well. In the Farm Bill, there are people who want to reduce the amount of money allotted to the CRP program. What is at stake?
The amount that is allotted depends upon each contract. Right now, we've got a limit of 32 million acres, and those dollars vary. In Iowa, we have some higher rate CRPs. The average runs in that $45, $50 range nationally, but in Iowa, it may be three or four times higher than that.
And right now, there have been a lot of conversations about people pulling land out of CRP, ending those contracts early, putting that land back in production to take advantage of the high commodity prices, particularly for corn. What do you know about those trends in Iowa and in Missouri and Kansas as well?
Well, those trends are occurring. We are seeing a reduction overall in CRP, but we're seeing a reduction because in the 2002 Farm Bill, there was 36 million acre cap. We saw that reduced in the 2008 Farm Bill to a 32 million acre cap. There's talk that they're going to lower the cap again this year, but we don't know, since that's being debated, what that'll end up being. But we are seeing a reduction in acres overall. Some areas it's getting better, some areas it's not, in that some areas still feel CRP is the best avenue for them.
I want to bring Dave Nomsen into the conversation now as well. He is Vice President of Government Affairs for Governmental Affairs for Pheasants Forever. Hello, Dave.
Hello from Washington, D.C.
Well, thank you for being on the show today. And Dave, first of all, for people who may not make the leap here, what is Pheasants Forever stake in this discussion?
Well, for us, it's pure mission. Our mission is wildlife habitat and conservation. We think there's a place on every farm, every ranch, for a little bit of wildlife habitat and conservation. So if we're doing good things for soil erosion, water quality, and wildlife habitat, that's what we're all about at Pheasants Forever.
And what do you see as far as trends right now with people taking land out of CRP?
Well, you know, we are concerned about that. We are seeing a pretty substantial loss of acreage in CRP, especially from some of the Northern Plains states and from the heartland of Iowa and other areas. But we're also seeing some hope in renewed interest in some of the targeted CRP practices, things like CRP Safe, or in Iowa, I understand there's some interest in the HEL CRP. So,
and what are those? I'm not familiar with those.
These are targeted practices that kind of help a farmer really, really plan out the best use of lands on their farm. And, for example, an eroding hilltop or a small area near a wetland or a stream. There are targeted small acreage practices that are ongoing in the continuous CRP program. And the rates tend to be a little more attractive there. So it's a good opportunity to check out.
When you look at people who are planting on what used to be CRP plan or CRP land, do you see it the way that John sees it? Do you see it because of the lowering cap for the amount of CRP acres in the Farm Bill? Or is this a trend because people are choosing to put land back into production?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things. First of all, here in D.C., in fact, the House bill, Farm Bill, is going to be on the floor this afternoon. And it is very likely that once Congress is done here with a House bill, if they can finish that up and through conference, nationwide CRP will likely go down somewhere to around 25 million acres. And so one of the ways that we're trying to help somewhat mitigate or offset those losses are to really refocus on the most efficient, best practices for smaller, more targeted areas. And pheasants and quail tend to be edge species, so we can grow an awful lot of birds with smaller acreage practices as well.
And, John, when we talk about these caps, when we say a 32-million-acre cap for CRP, are there 32 million acres in CRP right now?
No, there are not. Producers have voluntarily taken it out or not bid CRP back in as contracts expire. So we are below that cap right now. We're doing everything we can to try to make sure that producers know that there are acres available in those continuous programs that Dave talked about. The highly erodible land initiative that he talked about has been very popular in Iowa. The SAFE that he talked about has been so popular that we actually ran out of acres. We do have a second SAFE program that we just started that we have acres available in. And so, you know, there are caps that we are meeting on continuous, but the overall cap we are under nationally.
Can you give me an idea how many acres are in CRP right now?
Nationally, I don't remember for sure, but like in Iowa, we have 1.5 million plus, in Kansas, 2.3 plus, and in Missouri, about 1.1 plus. And so, you know, we have somewhere right around 5 million acres in those three states.
Dave, Pheasants Forever is supporting an amendment in the House that would tie crop insurance subsidies to conservation practices. Can you explain that amendment to me?
You know, I will. First, let me mention, though, that CRP nationally, we're just over 27 million acres enrolled right now, and we've got about 3.5 million roughly expiring this September. You know, another maybe short 200,000 of that in Iowa and other areas. But right now, one of the things we're doing out here in D.C. is supporting Amendment Number 28. Congressman Mike Thompson from California and Congressman Fortenberry from Nebraska are the authors of the amendment. And what it does is the amendment would tie conservation compliance, in other words, the need for farmers and landowners to complete a conservation plan on their farm, it would tie those requirements to crop insurance eligibility. And, you know, we think it's a very reasonable request, and we're pushing pretty hard right now to encourage all reps to vote for that amendment.
Why do you think that's important?
Well, I think it basically renews a pact, a conservation stewardship pact. This is not something new. Compliance was in place and tied to crop insurance, you know, prior to 96. It's a basic requirement. In fact, even if you want to sign up for the CRP program, you have to show that you're in compliance. So this isn't something new that's out there. And quite frankly, the vast, vast majority of farmers and landowners are already in compliance. So it's not a new burdensome restriction.
Okay, but if the majority are already in compliance, why is it important?
Well, unfortunately, there are a few out there. And I've been traveling a lot across the Northern Plains the last couple of years especially. And we are seeing, you know, unfortunately, because of the high commodity prices, high land values, we are seeing more poor decisions being made on certain lands, especially HEL lands and areas related to wetlands. And, of course, you know, a healthy wetland base is just critical for so many different things for all Iowans and everyone else, from the water quality benefits and other things alone. HEL areas, there are a small but very, very important remaining few native prairies in Iowa. And we're just trying to say, you know, let's have some plans before we decide what's the single best use of those acres.
And why is Pheasants Forever particularly concerned about Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, this area?
Well, first of all, I'm a native Iowan, so I've got some interest in this thing as well. But, you know, beyond that, pheasant hunting and the traditions of our nation's hunting heritage are so deep and family-rooted in most cases with friends and family. And you know, growing up in Iowa, the fall pheasant hunt was a special event as friends and family would gather. It's something that fits with and in harmony with agriculture. So pheasants and quail, it's all about the grasslands and the native habitats that we need.
All right. Well, Dave, thank you very much for being on the line with us today.
Thank you.
Dave Nomsen is Vice President of Governmental Affairs for Pheasants Forever. And John Whitaker, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I very much enjoyed it. Thank you.
John Whitaker is State Executive Director of the Farm Service Agency in Iowa, administrators of CRP in the state of Iowa. And, of course, as we heard, there will be a great deal of debate going on in the House of Representatives on the Farm Bill, and a lot is at stake this year. Talk of Iowa is produced by Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support today from Jason Burns in Ames, John Pemble in Des Moines, and Julie Englander in Iowa City. A special thanks to KCUR in Kansas City, and also a special thanks to Harvest Public Media as well. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.